Hey, everybody, this is Kyler Bingham with Salt Lake Dirt and KPCR 92.9 FM in Los Gatos. We are here today talking to a really incredible author. I just had the chance to read their work that came out last year, Geller Studies. Eric Fuhrer is here joining us on the show today. Eric, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So I think one thing that I love about I'm very naive when it comes to poetry, but I always enjoy when I find something I like. It sits with me for a long time, and I like reading. Sometimes, like with your book, I read it pretty quick, and then I just kind of kept coming back to it and picking out different ones that I enjoyed. Just a really incredible collection here. Maybe you could just talk to us a bit about the genesis of it, the project itself. It's, you know, it's a little over 100 pages, so there's quite a bit of work in there. And talk to me about just the beginnings of this specific project, Geller Studies, how it came about, and you know, your process of kind of putting these things together into one collection.
Sure. Yeah. So I feel like my work tends not to be super personal. And I always tried to write in a more certain personal narratives, but it never really felt right or came out in the right way. And then actually I wrote a book that's coming out this year first called My Buffed Up Life. And it's a memoir that kind of I speak in asides to Buffy the Vampire Slayer throughout it. And the weird thing is I could never write about these like trauma narratives in my life until one day I was watching Buffy and I wrote a line down about Buffy. I don't know, I started like a Buffy poem or something. And that became a way for me all of a sudden to start writing about myself. And it felt surprising that that happened because I wasn't expecting to write a Buffy line and all of a sudden unlock these things I wanted to write for all these years, but it was almost like I love Buffy and I love Sarah Michelle Gellar and her work. And I feel like in starting to think about and write about her work helped me unlock some kind of interest of mine that brought me back. I'm not really sure. But after I wrote that book, I thought I was done with writing about her characters. And then I wrote a poem that was kind of addressed to Daphne from Scooby-Doo. And then I started writing poems to Helen Shivers from I Know What You Did Last Summer, and then watched that movie again and realized that might be my favorite movie. And I really had no idea before. So I was learning a lot of things about myself through this process of writing. And again, being able to write about narratives that always seem to scary to write about, or when I wrote about them in the past felt like they were coming out in a way, I don't know if trite's the word, but it was a way that didn't feel like it was coming out in the right way. I'm not sure how to really say that. And then when I had Sarah Michelle Gellar to like buffer my work, all of a sudden it just felt more real.
No, I love that because I'm also like I'm a fan of Buffy and Sarah Michelle Gellar. I mean, how can you not be? I mean, I remember watching that show when it was on. So I haven't watched it in years, and just reading your work, it reminded me, like, you know, I think it has a, you know, a large cult fan base that's continued since the show left the air, but I'm always so interested in what makes a show really resonate with people. And I feel like this show, you know, maybe people dismissed it when it was on, like, oh, it's just a cheesy, like, teenage horror or whatever. But it did, like, it really packed a punch. And I feel like I'm going to need to go back and watch the show because it's been so long. But I just remember the strong emotional impact it had on me as a teenager when I was watching it. So I don't know. I mean, not really a question there, but I think, and I guess you kind of touched on it, when someone else's like work of art, which I, you know, TV show, a good TV show is a work of art. And when you kind of latch onto it, as a younger person, and it does kind of help get you through some tough times. Not saying there were tough times, but I know that's been my experience in it. And it's like, what is it about a show, you know, what is it about Sarah Michelle Gellar? What is it about a show like Buffy that some people hearing this may think like maybe dismissive of it? I don't think our listeners would be. I think they probably would agree with us here. But what was it about that show? Talk to me when you first started watching it. I'm thinking we might be around the same age. And like, what kind of an impact did it have on you at the time when you first kind of discovered the show?
Yeah, so I watched a little bit of it when it was on. And I always felt this weird, there was some kind of like weird gender pressure or something that I felt like I couldn't actually like the show because I loved her and I loved the show right away. And I did go to see her films. But I felt Buffy in particular was so packaged, especially when I was in middle school and high school, as like a show for young girls, that I feel like there was this just weird kind of improper object thing going on. Like I felt like I wasn't allowed to love it, and I wasn't allowed to love her. And just like I wasn't allowed to express my gender and stuff in certain ways. And I feel like that might be why later when I started writing about her, all of a sudden, like these personal narratives kind of came back in, because I think they all were always related, because somehow like my enjoyment of her work was felt wrong in the same way that my expression of who I was felt wrong. And she was wrapped up into that for some reason. And because a lot of her, I mean, Buffy especially, was just this such a gendered show from certain people's perspectives. I don't think it is. Yeah. And then what you were saying with, somebody was saying about Buffy being like emotional and not just being this like teenage show. That's kind of how I felt rewatching. I know we did last summer. I watched, when I was writing this book, I rewatched it like 10 times, and I was like hysterically crying every time I watched the scenes with her. And I was like, Eric, this is like a campy kind of teenage slasher. Why are you crying? But it's so deeply sad and moving, I think, you know.
And I agree.
Buffy, I feel like, is the same way. There is such emotional gravity in that show. Like when she kills Angel, it's devastating, you know? And then she has to like move to LA because she can't physically be in that same space. And it just feels so relatable and really, yeah, just really rich with emotion.
Yeah, no, it's so true. And I love when I get a collection of poetry initially kind of just going through the titles of the poems. That's one thing I always do, is I just kind of carefully, slowly read through the titles before I jump into the work itself. And it hooked me immediately just reading that contents page where you have the titles. And I was like, I know I'm going to get along with Eric just going through these. So like I'll just read a couple. Like so for Sarah Michelle Gellar, obviously a shot of Gellar was I love it. I mean, it just flowed before even reading it. It just seemed to just it flowed, if that makes sense. So I guess my question is, when you piece together a collection like this, one thing I'm always impressed by is the placement of the poems, and how much thought must go through. I think of like a good album where the songs are very, you know, it's highly deliberate with how everything is laid out. So I wanted to ask you one about that, about like the laying out of the poems. And then maybe we could jump into like the specifics of the writing itself. So initially, let's talk about placement of poems. And then in your process, do you kind of have like an overarching idea of how you want the book to unfold and you write in order, or do you find yourself jumping around quite a bit?
I find myself mostly jumping around. Like, I'll have a theme, which was her work here, and I'll write poems around that. And then the way that I kind of started ordering it, once I started thinking it was nearing completion, was one, I wanted to kind of space out, because I have some poems that are to specific characters. I wanted to make sure they were spaced out a bit. And then also in terms of heaviness and lightness, right? Like, I have this poem for Daphne Blake, which is the one that started the collection originally, but now it's, I think, the third or fourth poem, because that I felt broke things up a little bit, because it was a little bit more positive and fun, and the language was kind of more fun in it, and some of the poems can get a little bit darker. So I was trying to think of ways to balance that experience for a reader and for myself as well. Like, how did I want my experience to read on the page? And I kind of wanted it to read in ways that felt like it ebbed a little bit. Because for me, some of them can be quite heavy.
Yeah. Yeah. And then when you're working on, you know, I'm always fascinated by the process of revising and working through drafts and kind of getting the language of it right, or satisfactory at the very least. So when you're working on a specific poem, how, and I know it's kind of a tough, maybe kind of a, like a, I don't know, annoying question to talk about process sometimes, but I'm always as fascinated, because I don't write poetry. And I, like I said, when I find something that I am enjoying, I tend to devour it and really just like am honestly a bit in awe when people can pull this off in a way that has like a strong emotional resonance on me. So when I'm sure every poem is different in its own way, but when you, you know, typically when you're working, how do you even begin a poem? Does it start with a word or a sentence or a theme, an idea? And then when you kind of get it going, like, how much revision do you go through on a typical poem? How many drafts would you say until you feel like, okay, this is solid, this is what I want it to express?
So with this book, I think most of the poems started with an image, and the majority of them started with image from her work. So I don't really think that any of the poems, I guess I Know What You Did Last Summer, those poems, and then maybe the one in Cruel Intentions kind of interacts with the characters the most. But I feel like the other poems interact with her work in ways that are highly personal. So like, there's an image that maybe is something that resonated with me, but maybe isn't the most important image of her film. So you're kind of getting her work filtered, obviously filtered through me because I'm writing it, but also filtered through like a very personal connection and vision that I have of her work. And it would start with that image. And then I kind of build from that image. So I feel like I start building from that. And then I feel like in this book, I would write at the same time, simultaneously, the parts that are kind of to her characters, and then the parts that kind of pull out and are about me.
Yeah.
And then I would think about how those fit together.
That's so interesting. And I love like the, that's interesting you say an image or something, because I felt very strong visuals came to me as I read this, and, like the images of water, the baptism. That was a very, that stuck with me and was very visual. And you had the visual element of it, but then, you know, there's more going on, of course. So I would just like to talk a bit about maybe your background with, when did you start writing and feeling like it, hopefully was a way for you, whether you shared it or not, just a way for you to communicate, who you are as a person. And then, you know, you can share as much or as little as you want. I'm wondering if there's a religious background that was imposed upon you at a young age. I kind of got that sense. So I'd love to hear about that if you're up to talk about it. If not, I completely understand, because I've experienced that kind of life myself, and it can be a tricky one to, you know, it's complex and can be challenging to talk about, but I just was really related to a lot of it in that capacity, and it brought up a lot of my own emotions and feelings about things that I still have conflicted emotions about.
Yeah, so I started writing, I think, probably in high school, and that was a way for me to kind of process things at that point. You know, the book does talk about a lot of, like, the memoir will talk about it more, but it talks a lot about, like, a lot of childhood abuse and stuff. And that was a way for me to kind of process that. And then I wasn't able to reprocess it again until these books. So I'm very grateful to these books and to Sarah for that help. But yes, definitely religious background that was forced upon me. I was brought up Baptist, and I also would go to these like revival things where we went to like a Coliseum that usually you would see like Bruce Springsteen. Sorry, you see like Bruce Springsteen or something, but we went and we saw Benny Hinn, who's this preacher, and everybody would come up to get healed. And it was this whole big production, and people would be putting money, like tons of money, in these baskets. And he would have these people come up. Like, just there was like a line of people in wheelchairs, and they would all pick their wheelchairs up and push them off the stage and say, "We could walk now," you know. And it was just this big production that really just generated lots of cash for him, I think. And that was a really big part of my upbringing. And then fear, kind of related to that, was also a big part of my upbringing, you know, because if you don't do certain things will happen. So part of it with this was this pageantry, and part of it was like a lot of this fear mongering.
Yeah. That's exactly what I was going to ask you. I was going to, did you find yourself kind of in a state of, did it provide any level of comfort, or was it more of a fear-based kind of thing that you had to grapple with? And, you know, when that's your reality, especially as a kid, of course you believe, because that's what you're, or you believe it to some extent. That's what you're surrounded by. Everyone else, like a group of people, is a powerful thing to be around when they're believing in one thing. So it sounds like the fear was more of an impact on you.
Yeah, but that's why also in this book, like you said, the ideas of baptism and stuff, and ideas of, like, at one point I tell one of her characters that I would hand her fish over and over again until we realized that we belong. The imagery of, you know, Christianity has become really important to me to kind of reclaim as something positive, you know? So that's something I feel like is happening a few times in this book too, where, you know, her characters and me are kind of trying to be these kind of biblical characters or something that are finally able to like have this narrative that's not being impressed upon us, but that we're like the bodies in it, if that makes sense.
No, it makes complete sense. That's beautiful. I love that. Kind of reclaiming elements. I think that can be so important and empowering. What about kind of jumping around here, but like just like influences that you gravitated towards, either now or I'm always curious when people were younger, when they start kind of, you know, gravitating towards something that is not, imposed upon them, when you start using your own autonomy, things that, that you enjoy that maybe no one else around you is, whether it be, you know, writers or musicians or films or whatever you had access to. And, you know, I know some people when they grow up in a very religious household, they're kind of limited in what they are able to bring into the home. So they either secretly do that or they find it later in life. So I just love to hear about influences, things that you gravitated towards in an artistic way. Things that really brought you joy, and maybe even though you don't know these people, a sense of community in a sort.
Yeah. Back then, I would say Tori Amos is someone that's super, super important to me and still is. And Sarah Michelle Gellar as well. Not Buffy, because I had grappled with that a little bit, but her other films I loved, and I loved her, and they were influences early on, and I think kept being influences. And then I think, even though I am a writer, like when anybody asks me what my favorite book is, I always think of a TV show instead or like a movie. But I feel like recently there's something about things that just feel, this is, I'm not sure if I can articulate this correctly, but things that feel like a different genre. So like Tori Amos's music to me kind of feels like poetry, kind of feels like I'm watching something even though it's not there, right? Mm-hmm. There's something that's very visual about it. And, you know, there's something about Sarah Michelle Gellar's work that feels very poetic to me as well. And sound is really important in every work as well. And I'm thinking about, there's this show, Superman and Lois, and I feel like that's the most recent show that I feel like made me feel like I was, I don't know, like becoming a music note or something. I can't really describe what it really felt like, but like the beginning of that show, I remember I was painting, we were selling our house in Indiana, and I was painting, and I was like, I'm going to put on, painting like my windows, so I'm going to put on a show that I can just like turn my brain off, and I put this show on, and then I'm standing with this brush, like hysterically crying at the first 5 minutes of the show, because it's so gorgeous, and it was like very montage-y, but there was something about it that just felt like, even though it was a TV show, it was crossing something. So maybe it's something about spiritualness to me and the way I feel about that now. I'm not really sure, but maybe it is that felt spiritual. Sarah Michelle Gellar's, a lot of her work feels spiritual, and Tori Amos's work feels incredibly spiritual.
Absolutely. Oh, that's so cool. And then it is funny, because I've heard other people say this, and I've kind of adopted this philosophy of, is there's no guilty pleasures. I think just like, if you like it, you like it. I love that. I think when I was younger, kind of what you mentioned about like watching Buffy when you were younger, like you're not allowed to, you don't fit the mold for the demographic or whatever who's supposed to watch this, but you resonate with it. And so I think like those things are so important to just be like, I like this show, and you know, maybe a lot of people don't like it, but a lot of people do love it. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you have an emotional response to something, that's great. And I think that can really give you insight into, it's like therapy, like good therapy can really give you some strong insight. So I think good art, and even like a, like what some would consider a silly TV show, you know, I've been in the same position where you watch something and it's like, it has such a powerful emotional impact. Sometimes I think I can figure out, and it's like, wow, maybe I don't really know myself as well as I thought I did. It has this powerful emotional, like stimulus or whatever that comes over me. And I think about it a lot. I'm like, what was that? What was that scene that really got to me or has me thinking about it? And I don't know if fun is the right word, but sometimes it's like, it's fun when you begin to, you get to know yourself a little better. That experience never like really goes away if you're honest with yourself. You know, I'd love to hear about just, you know, your journey about, identifying as a queer writer. I don't really have a specific question, but just the journey that kind of led you to there. And maybe that's like a can of worms. I'm asking you to open up, but I think like self-discovery, you know, unfortunately so many people never get there and they live unhappy lives because of it. So your journey coming from, a very like religious upbringing that, frowned upon may be too light of a term, about becoming who you truly are, truly are as a person and reflecting that in your art. I don't know if that makes sense what I'm trying to ask here. I'm just prying a bit, I guess.
I think that goes back to what I was saying about like not wanting to own my love for Buffy early on, because I know that at that moment I was very much grappling with my queerness and very much afraid of it, because I'm very much afraid of the way other people have reacted to it and very much trying to hide it at that point. And I think I felt like liking the show openly would kind of expose me or something. And there was a great fear in that. So I feel like fear was really operated very heavily in my life at that point. And one of the poems in this book actually talks about one of the events that made me afraid of being able to express myself at that point. And I think it was a long time until I felt like I was able to. I feel like I fully kind of came out and felt more comfortable with myself and in my writing. I think this is the first time in my writing that I'm pretty open about it, but probably like in like 2020 or something. So it took a while, or well over 30 years of my life. And it was oddly at the University of Notre Dame, where I was adjuncting at the time, because I got my MFA there, and talk about like, you know, starting off in forced like religion and then being at a place that felt super weird to me. And I didn't expect when I first attended there for it to feel as weird as it did, but it did feel like I was kind of back in some kind of childhood thing. But oddly, being back in that space was what made me feel not safe enough. I wouldn't say safe was the word, but brave enough, I guess, to kind of say like, you know, I'm tired of feeling like this and I'm just going to live my truth more. And that felt good. And now I'm no longer there and I'm in LA and I feel better here.
That's great. So I love that. So you're from Indiana originally. Is that where?
I'm from New York originally.
You're from New York. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, moving to LA. So when did you move to LA? And that's another thing I love talking to people about when they make the move to Los Angeles, because it is, I think so many people gravitate towards there, people who feel like outsiders, and then you're in a overwhelmed with outsiders, where it can be such a beautiful and overwhelming experience. Mm-hmm. Talk to me about the decision to move there. And when you did, and just kind of your experience those first few months.
So basically we had moved to Indiana so I can get my degree. And then we had been there for about 10 years. I had a small stint in Iowa, which I loved Iowa, but then I ended up coming back to Indiana. So it was longer than I expected to be there. So at one point I just said, you know, this is not where I want to be, and I want to be somewhere else. And I talked to my partner about it, and we thought about places we could go. I wanted to be in a larger city. She wanted that too. So we were going to go back to New York possibly, but then we thought LA was warm and I was just tired of being cold. So we decided to come here, and it's really, I've had a really good experience here. I know that some people, you know, everybody compares New York and LA. So people are like, oh, in New York, people are like this, and LA people are like this. And I have really loved LA people and being in LA, and it's felt very like it's made me happy. I feel like when I dress like this in Indiana, people would give me looks and make you feel like I'd come off a spaceship or something. But now I've had people ask me if I'm a fashion designer. I've had people like compliment me. It just feels really nice to like have people just acknowledge you for like positive things and then just be pleasant to you, you know? And not that that never happened in Indiana, but I did feel like at certain times for the way I dressed, there was some pushback or some weirdness that I don't have to experience here.
Sure. Or like defend yourself or whatever. I mean, and that was like, when you popped on the screen, I'm like, oh my God, I love your clothes. Like, I'm jealous. I wish I had this outfit. so I mean, and that's great. I love that. Talk to me about being in the field of academia. So you teach. What do you teach? And what kind of led you to the path of, you know, being a professor?
So right now I teach at a high school in West Hollywood. It's small, so there's about 96 students there. So you get to know them really well. I teach 12th grade and I'm the college counselor there. I really love it. I really get to know all the kids, again, like super well, because we have classes and then we also have tutorials. So I get to meet with them two-on-one every week. So I really get to know them better than I've actually known any of my students in the past. So it's really, really nice. And the whole school is all about individual expression. So I'm just really helping them become more of who they want to be, which is really facilitated in the school better than it is other places, because that's kind of their philosophy here. So that's been really, really fun. Yeah, I really love the school.
I love that. I'll have to talk to you off the record at some point, because I'm a high school teacher. I teach mostly seniors, 12th grade and 11th grade, public school, a different animal. I'll take kind of a, you know, but yeah, I'd love to like pick your brain about that at some point, because I think like people who are in this field, like, you know, I can talk about it with friends and family who are not, but they can only understand it so far. So when you're with someone, and I especially love talking to people who are in a different kind of school than I am, because I love talking about the similarities and the differences, and there's just and the age group, that age, the teenagers now in 2024, it's fascinating. I think they get a bad rep, you know, they really do. And I find I've been in this field for 15 years in like a public school setting. And I really do. They've, you know, of course there's like, but just like in the world with people, there's some off people. There's a lot of great people. And I think that just, they're just people. They're just younger and they have a lot more to deal with than a lot of us had to deal with at that age. So props to them. One thing I've noticed, and I'll, you know, just on a personal note, like that I've found so interesting since the pandemic, after the pandemic, I've noticed, many, many, many students, I've never seen the level of kindness and empathy, exhibited in teenagers, at about 2021. It started, I just noticed it, and I just, it was a really interesting. And so I'm always like, curious, I don't know. I mean, I love to talk to educators from around the country, especially, and just see, if they, if they've had an experience like that. I know, maybe this is your first time working with high school students. But I think like, I would just love to give them a bit of a shout out. I mean, I feel, and it's cliche sounding, but I feel like I learn more from them in so many ways than I am teaching them. So I think that's so cool. You're able to have that, that individual contact with them within a small school setting like that. It sounds great. So, yeah, are the kids all right? I guess I should ask, are the kids okay from your perspective?
Yeah, I think they get a bad rap too. I think there's always that phrase, you know, like, oh, kids these days don't know how to do this, or kids don't know how to do that. And people were saying that about kids my day too, when I was in high school, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Same thing happened. I remember everybody saying, kids these days can't do this. And I was like, well, they can. And then I bet you people from the generation before and the generation before.
Yeah.
I mean, I know a professor of mine was, when someone said, like, back in the day, like one of the people in the class, and he was like, you know, Benjamin Franklin and like, you know, 1700, whatever, has like a journal entry where he says, kids these days don't know how to do, you know, and that's like so long ago. So it's always been, people always judge people for the lack. And it also feels like, sure, they probably have a lack of something, and that's why they're here, to be educated, right?
So yeah.
That's part of you helping them. Everybody's going to have a different gap, right?
Yeah.
And you're trying to help them through that. And we have our own gaps. But yeah, I just feel like that's kind of a blanket statement that's always been used. And then whenever I hear people use it against this, because I've heard people use it against this age students. And then I point that out and they go, yeah, yeah, yeah. But these kids, really? And I'm like, well, I mean, some of them, not all of them, me too sometimes. Some of the things you're pointing out, I do a little bit, and we all have our flaws.
I love that. I read a book recently. It was just, I teach mostly U.S. history and humanities, and this book was, it had quotes from a newspaper article. It was soon before America got involved in World War II, and it was interviewing people that had either fought in World War I or were of that age. And they were just like, we're doomed, because if this, they're talking about the quote unquote greatest generation, that was, you know, put upon the name much later, but they're saying that if these kids have to defend us, we're doomed. And, and now they're just like elevated to being, you know, the greatest generation, which I think they gave themselves that name. I don't know. But yeah, it's so true. It's like people are always, and I have to catch myself, because I, you know, I fall into it sometimes, like, oh, you know, but it's like, I think that's such a humble, cool approach to it, where it's like, you know, maybe I'm on my phone a little too much, or I'm doing this or whatever. It's like, we're all just human beings. And most of us are trying to just do the best we can. and you know, well, that's great. Let's talk about, this has kind of just flown by tonight. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Let's tell people where they can pick up the book, if there's any social media accounts that you'd like to direct people towards. And then the upcoming book, is there a release date yet for it? When can we, or roughly like, when can we look forward to reading that?
Mm-hmm. So you could buy it on Spike and Dival's website, or any place really you could buy online books. And then the release date for my Buffed Up Life is going to be somewhere around June, but I still have to settle on the date, but it's going to be mid-year. So.
Wonderful. And then any websites, social media that you would, people can kind of follow your journey and just see what you're up to?
Sure. I'm on Instagram at Eric J. Fuhr, and my website is eric-fuhr.com.
Wonderful. So I'll have links to where people can you know, easily get to that and follow. I really encourage people to check out Geller Studies. Like I said, I loved it. I thought it was a wonderful collection. And I really look forward to reading the next one. I'd love to have you back on if you're up for it. We could talk about the new one after I get a chance to read it. But Eric, this has been a wonderful chat. Thank you so much for being on today.
Yeah, thank you so much.